Nous devons apprendre à nous tenir ensemble en tant que citoyens du monde pour une communauté plus saine, plus sûre et plus heureuse.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is March 26th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT is broadcasting out from this unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyankahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jesmer.
Hey, I'm Kate Addison.
I'm Alice Wu, and I help make Friday's Off the Hour show. My favorite sound is when a really talented soprano hits those free, floating high notes. And I like it because I enjoy singing myself, but I'm not quite as talented as that just yet.
My favorite sound is the sound of a rapidly moving river when it crashes all over. I like it because it means I'm outside and it's peaceful. CKUT is having a funding drive right now.
CKUT is having a funding drive right now because your support keeps this community radio on the air. We have a goal of raising $100 in this hour.
We can only do it with your help.
So call 514-448-4041.
514-448-4041 to talk to a volunteer, or you can donate online at ckut.ca.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Friday's edition of Off the Hour on CKUT.
On CKUT
90.3 FM.
But first, news.
Presumptive cases of COVID-19 variants are on the rise in Quebec. Variant cases rose to 4,682 province-wide on Thursday. Meanwhile, Quebec is slowly reopening, starting with gyms.
Isabelle Charest is Quebec's junior education minister.
I would like, however, for us to remember that we have to go progressively. It is only by going slowly that we'll be able to do those activities that make us so happy.
And workers and activists from the Immigrant Workers Center gathered Tuesday to hand out masks at a Montreal metro station. They say they're celebrating improvements in Dollarama's labor conditions and want Dollarama to hire workers directly. And Montreal's police department arrested 21-year-old Ali Garouki this week. He allegedly assaulted Officer Sanjay Vig on January 28th. The attack of this officer prompted a wrongful arrest of Mamadi Kamara in February. His arrest renewed conversations about anti-black racism in the city's police force. And a LaSalle woman died Tuesday from domestic violence injuries. Rebecca Harry was 29 years old. Some advocates and provincial ministers have said Quebec's curfew measures can deter women from leaving violent home situations for fear of being fined. Harry's death means 7 Quebec women have died in the last 7 weeks. And protesters gathered at Cabot Square this Monday to protest hate crimes against Asian communities. Marchers gathered later for a vigil at Park Sun Yat-sen to commemorate the victims of a recent shooting in Atlanta. 8 people were killed and 6 of them were Asian women.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. My name is Brian Jefferson. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, a group of around 15 people gathered in the parking lot of a Laval prison last Saturday morning. Sarah Jesmer has more.
Almost exactly 1 year ago today, a maximum security provincial prison in Ontario publicized its very first case of COVID-19 involving those inside. Reports from March 20th, 2020 say it was a staff member at Toronto's South Detention Center who got sick. A detainee tested positive about a week later. Cases began to spread quickly after that in prisons all over Canada. 1 year later, on March 20th, 2021, last Saturday, anti-carceral groups from coast to coast marked the day by demonstrations and by reflecting on what they've been seeing looking from the outside in. This is at the Immigration Holding Center in Laval, Quebec. It's run by the Canada Border Services Agency, or the CBSA. It's on the same property as two federal and one provincial prisons. A handful of Montrealers are marking what many are calling a day of liberation. Some are holding hand-painted and printed banners under the bright blue sky on the gray pavement. They stood in a half circle around a single speaker and sanitized the mic between words of reflection on justice as they passed it around.
We are here today located on unceded Indigenous lands. The Ganyankahaga are the custodians of these lands, and we should recognize our presence on these lands.
Here's Dr. Arnold Aberman. He's got on a blue coat as he speaks through his mask. Aberman is a general practitioner and a member of the Caring for Social Justice Collective.
Is antiquated, cruel, and can't be fixed. The detainees must be released. The reason why I'm saying the carceral system is racist is very simple. If you look who's in the prisons today, it's definitely overrepresented by marginalized groups. Indigenous populations, which only account for 5% of the Canadian population, account for 30% of those who are in prison. Among those, 15 to 20% have experienced residential schools. In Manitoba, 75% are Indigenous. Saskatchewan, 75% are Indigenous. Indigenous youth, which account for only 7% of the general population, are 33% within the carceral system. Young Indigenous women account for 44% of the women in prison. Blacks, which account for only 3% of the general population, are 7.2% in prison. And people with mental health problems, approximately 80% of the youth and almost 80% of the women who are in prison have mental health problems. Prisons, why does this occur? Because prisons are a reflection of our society. We live in a society that is racist, colonialist, patriarchal, classist, homophobic, and the prison system is just a reflection of that. The use of force in prison is another manifestation of the racism. Who is subjected to force? Who's subjected to restrictions? Cayenne, isolation, physical force. Although they account for 30% of the detainees, 47% of the people who are subjected to use of force are Indigenous. And in particular, the young Indigenous people, those who are 18 to 21 years old, 70% of those who are faced, who are subjected to force in prison are them. And they only account for 33% of those in prison. Another aspect that we often forget about the prison system is the child welfare crisis and the youth centers, the Saint Jeunesse in Quebec. I worked in a Saint Jeunesse with the youth for about 8 years, and those who are in closed units are definitely a form of prison. Indigenous youth, again, in the child welfare system, accounts for 48% of the youth in Canada, 17% in Quebec, where they only account for 3% of the population. And in the prairies, it's much worse. There are up to 90% of those in child welfare are of Indigenous origin. Now we'll talk about the immigration holding centers, the detention centers. These are, you have to remember that because of the Safe Third Country Agreement, the number of detainees are much lower this year than in previous years, but still, Since the month of September, according to the CBSA statistics, there have been almost 800 people in detention, 161 in Quebec. And there have been about 142 people have been in detention for over 3 months. And you have to remember, children are still in detention. Since the month of September, 5 children have been in detention, including one who is under 5 years old. I will read you now from a document that was produced two years ago that was endorsed by the Human Rights Watch, because it says very well what I want to say. Canada's treatment of vulnerable individuals in immigration detention, including children and persons with psychosocial disabilities or mental health conditions, continues to violate binding international law, such as the right to equality, liberty, and security of the person, and the right to an effective remedy. In many cases, the treatment constitutes arbitrary detention, as well as cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. Canada's treatment of children in the context of immigration detention also violates the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Canada had signed that convention. There is overwhelming evidence that immigration detention has a devastating impact on individuals' mental health. According to the CBSA, although the CBSA justifies transferring immigration detainees from detention units to provincial jails in order to improve access to mental health services, those who suffer from depression, post-traumatic stress, or anxiety often do not receive any treatment at all. Individuals who have expressed distress and the will to commit suicide are sometimes kept in solitary confinement, which is ridiculous. Studies from Canada and around the world clearly indicate that detention causes psychological illness, trauma, depression, anxiety, aggression, and other physical, emotional, and psychological consequences. Uncertainty about the end date of detention is one of the most stressful aspects of the system. Detention can be particularly damaging to vulnerable individuals, including asylum seekers and victims of torture. Now we'll talk about children. Since 2013, more than 800 children have spent time in Canadian immigration detention. However, even where there are no grounds for detention, children may be housed in detention in order to avoid separating them from their detained parents. Children who do not accompany their detained parents may be at risk of being transferred to government child protection services. It is not clear how many children are separated from their detained parents, as CBSA has not collected this data. Detention conditions are woefully inadequate and unsuited for children. Access to doctors and mental health counseling is limited, and children receive inadequate education and poor nutrition. Recreational activities are generally sedentary, mobility is severely restricted, and children rarely get the opportunity to socialize with other peers their age. Essentially, children are deprived of an environment where they can develop normally. Now, what is the impact of COVID on prisons and detention centers? We're going to look here also how systemic racism affects those who are in prison related to COVID. By February 2021, 57% of the 880 COVID cases were Indigenous during the second wave within the federal carceral system. Overall, 10% of the total inmate population versus only 2% of the Canadian population have so far contracted the disease. Between February 2020 and February 2021, the Indigenous inmate population declined by 7.6%. In comparison, the non-Indigenous population declined by 14.4%. In other words, the non-Indigenous inmate population declined at twice the rate of the Indigenous inmate population. COVID-related complaints since the start of the pandemic have also increased, and here are some examples. This is from the Office of Correctional Investigator, who have received 500 complaints over the past year. I'll only list the ones that are related to health concerns. Restricted access to health care and medications due to lockdown. Lack of or limited access to fresh air, exercise, and yard. Availability and access to sanitation supplies and personal protective equipment. Staff not compliant with protective measures, not wearing masks, gloves, PPEs, use of pat-downs, strip searches, mixing with symptomatic inmates. Another concern is the accumulated, in some cases, indefinite nature of solitary confinement and extended periods of lockdown on inmate physical health and mental well-being. Amnesty International, in a report in 2018 concerning a decision by a BC court, says the following. relying on evidence from lay witnesses, including correctional staff and prisoners who had experienced solitary confinement, as well as expert evidence, the BC court found that solitary confinement places prisoners at significant risk of serious psychological harm, including mental pain and suffering, and increase of self-harm and suicide. Another example that occurred in Canadian penitentiaries is at Stony Mountain and Saskatchewan penitentiaries, that once the virus is introduced inside the prison, it spreads quickly and indiscriminately. Prisoners do not necessarily have the ability or means to practice safe distancing and maintaining hygiene and sanitation behind bars that can be challenging at the best of times. The daily movement of staff from outside communities experiencing outbreaks creates potential vectors of disease transmission inside prisons. For elderly and medically compromised inmates, the risk of contracting COVID inside prison can be life-altering and even deadly. And from this office, his recommendations as well were to release detainees to the community. In other words, the detention system, like I said at first, is cruel, unjust, and can't be fixed. The detainees must be released and must have access to health care, irregardless of their status. Thank you.
Other groups represented here are Solidarity Across Borders, Anti-Carceral Group, the Montreal version of the Anti-Carceral Group, the Housing Action Committee of Park Extension. The goals of their groups are different, but they intersect on the stance of how effective incarceration is on overall safety. Here's Mocha Dawkins, a Black trans freedom fighter and community activist.
I won't take too much of your time. What I just want to bring to your attention is the fact that we have the federal government looking at the history of Canada and issuing out apologies to refugees. So just as the Jewish refugees came in 1939 and got refused, we stand here today and we recognize Canada's refusal to migrants. We stand here and we see that we are not moving forward in the progression of equality. When we turn around and we think that we have different embassies all over the world, as people have embassies in this country, and yet before they offer them a proper civil privilege to get the proper assistance from the embassies, they turn around and incarcerate them. They show them the disgusting side of Canada. And this is something that the government can no longer apologize for, because they do nothing to repair the situation. It takes us, civil citizens of Canada, to recognize the ignorance of our own country and to come together and organize events like these to get the word out to people who are supposed to be our leaders. This is something that has to change. We are the generation of change. I'm from the 90s. I don't know about y'all. You know, I was born in 1990. You know what I'm saying? And I was told when I was growing up that we were the future, that we were here and that we were supposed to make a better future. But how can we make a better future when we still live in the past? So that's the little type of recognition that I want to bring today, the type of hope that I hope these people get to feel today, even though they don't know that we're actually out here. Some of them don't know we're out here for them. I hope leaders actually listen to what's being said, to take into account the civil responsibility that the citizens are taking upon themselves and the care and the compassion that we are exhibiting. And I hope that they implement that into their ethical practices when they look into how they allow people to come into this country. The one thing that I want to say is Trudeau had gave so much money in aid to different countries over different things. And he knows, he understands that, he understands that people are fleeing poverty, people are fleeing violence. But yet, the same people who are fleeing these things, he subjects them to this type of treatment. He makes Canada no better. He makes us all look disgusting. And with that being said, so may equality happen for all.
Demonstrations were also held in Toronto and Saskatchewan. Wendy Barateau is a paralegal and a member of the anti-carceral group. She says the pandemic has shown people what effects staying isolated and solitary at home can have on mental health. Barateau says she hopes it'll help stoke empathy in others.
So imagine spending a year in your bathroom. Take the tub away, replace your tub by a bed. You got your counter and you got your toilet, and that's your life for a year. You rarely get out of there. You don't get any human contact or hardly any, no, I don't like to generalize. You hardly get any human contact. You don't get out of there. You can't phone as you will. You're not getting visits. We outside, we find it hard being in our houses, you know, with some human contact, with Zoom meetings, with our phones, with our televisions, right? Imagine that not taking it away. Bathroom, TV, that's it. Try doing it for 2 days. I challenge you to stay in your bathroom for 2 days. Not talking to anybody and see how you feel about that. So this is how we're treating our inmates right now. I'm gonna end by, I always end by this. I do lectures in university and this is what I say. I said every inmate eventually is gonna leave the prison system, right? There are eventually, they're gonna go out. They're gonna be somebody's neighbor, right? So who do you want as your neighbor? Do you want somebody that's been treated humanely? You know, that's been shown compassion? That's been shown the good side of humanity? That is not angry? Or do you want somebody that's been treated almost like an animal? You know, no respect as your neighbor. Just think about it. Je vais vous laisser en disant ça. Je dis, chaque personne détenue éventuellement va sortir. Éventuellement, cette personne-là va être le voisin de quelqu'un d'autre. Qu'est-ce que vous voulez comme un voisin? Est-ce que vous voulez un voisin qui a été traité de façon humaine, avec compassion, avec un sens d'être agrandi, avec un sens de soi agrandi, ou vous voulez quelqu'un qui a été opprimé, violenté, traité comme moins qu'un humain? Pensez-y. Quand vous allez rencontrer votre voisin, on ne sait jamais, hein? When you meet your neighbor, you never know who they're going to be. Thank you.
I just wanted to add, and which was very important, and it was mentioned, mental health issues. A lot of people that are the highest number of deaths, non-natural deaths, is suicide in incarceration. And we can look at the Ashley Smith case or the Sully case, where people with mental disorders that are incarcerated end up dying at the hands of guards. And the only thing that's done about it is actually a coroner's inquest. And nothing else. The guards, Ashley Smith's guard, we had 5 guards filming her, and none of them were charged with anything. And if any civilian would film somebody dying and not help, we would all be detained ourselves, right? So same thing in the Sully case. So mental health issues, I think the doctor said it well, it reflects your society when you're inside. Whatever happens on the outside is tenfold on the inside. So if we don't take care of our mental health people on the outside, they definitely don't take care of them on the inside. They're over-medicated. Apparently there's no more solitary confinement. But basically, with the last report that was out, there's actually solitary confinement. So I don't care what the minister says, it's there and it's alive and unwell. So mental health issues and death and incarceration is high. There's a transgender person that died in Joliet, and I remember that because she died in the house I was in before I transferred out to FVI, I think a year after I transferred out. And she had been complaining to the health system for a week that she was having headaches, she was feeling unwell. They kept giving her Tylenols and thinking that she was after drugs. And they found her dead in her room from a heart attack. The coroner inquest said that she had been having heart attacks, little heart attacks, for a week. And she could have been saved. But the health system ignored her. And most of the cases, and if you look at the coroner's inquest or correctional investigators, this is the case of deaths in prison. Their inmates are ignored. I didn't die. But for a week, after I left maximum security in 2012, about a month after, I was getting really bad headaches, and I don't get headaches. They gave me Tylenols. I kept going back. They said, well, you're starting migraines. I said, I don't have migraines. I don't have a history of migraines. You know, they gave me migraines medication, and then that lasted for a week, and then they finally decided to send me to emergency, and I had meningitis. I was hoping it was bacterial because, you know, for a week I was walking around the jail. They would have had to disinfect the whole jail. But unfortunately, it was just viral, so they had no consequences to that. But for a week, they put me off when I had meningitis. It could have been really bad. So this is the case that happens a lot. So mental health issues is huge. We don't want to treat them outside, and then when something happens, we send them inside. And then we don't even treat them inside. I was sent to Pinel in December 2013 because I became manic. They were giving me medication saying I was bipolar. Pinel in 2013 told them I wasn't manic, that I do severe reactions to antidepressants and mood stabilizer. And throughout my correctional reports until I transferred out to Fraser Valley Institution, my parole officer at Joliet kept indicating that I was refusing to take my medication and that I was still a danger outside, even though Pinel told them that the medication was making me ill. So they do whatever they want. It's a big issue. I just wanted to add that because I don't want to pass over mental health. And another thing is the fastest growing population in incarceration are Indigenous women. And that's horrible. They kill us inside, outside. They do inquests and they do nothing about the inquest. They put us inside. I mean, I've seen so many Indigenous women in long-term segregation, 3 years in segregation, not seeing anybody is horrible. I mean, already a mental health issue, fetal alcohol syndrome issues, and then 3 years of no human contacts. And then they say, well, we can't cure them. We can't do anything with them. Well, you're not doing anything anyways. So that's horrible. Thank you.
This day marks the first reported case at Toronto South Detention Center. The first case of COVID-19 in a Quebec prison was on March 26th, this day, last year, at a federal prison called Port-Cartier. And as of updates given today, 1 year later, on March 26th, 2021, there are zero sick detainees in any federal or provincial prison within Quebec since at least February 1st of this year. This does not count any cases that are at CBSA's Immigration Holding Center, where this demonstration took place. Even so, advocates and community members say incarceration, even in COVID-19 free prisons or environments, causes more harm than good. And before the group parted, Bill Vandriel with Solidarity Across Borders took a moment to recognize that the March Saturday afternoon also marked 3 years since a woman, Lucy, was deported from Montreal. People within the city campaigned to halt her deportation all those years ago. Vandriel reflected on that significance in French.
Mais aussi, le 20 mars, ça marque le troisième anniversaire de l'arrestation de Lucy Granados. Lucy, qui était membre de Solidarité sans frontières, membre de l'ETAP, l'Association de travailleurs de l'agence de placement, et juste un membre tellement important de notre communauté, mais aussi une femme sans statut ici au Canada. Et elle était arrêtée le matin de 20 mars chez elle. Elle était toute seule, une femme toute seule avec, je crois, 5 agents de service frontalier qui est entré dans son appartement. Elle était blessée pendant l'arrestation et elle, après ça, elle était détenue ici aussi. Et elle était vraiment maltraitée. Elle était vraiment blessée dans une manière sérieuse. Mais le médecin ici au centre a dit à elle que, oh non, tu es correct. Prends le Tylenol, prends des pilules, tu vas être correct. Finalement, après son déportation, quand elle était capable de voir un vrai médecin pour la première fois, cette médecin a dit que, oh non, 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 c'est vraiment plus sérieux que ça. Et jusqu'à aujourd'hui, elle vit avec les conséquences et la douleur à cause de cette blessure. À cause de ça, c'est clair que les problèmes au niveau de santé et la situation aux détentions et aux prisons, c'est pas quelque chose juste pendant la pandémie. Les problèmes existent comme ça avant de la pandémie et vont continuer après la pandémie. Mais alors, à cause de ça, c'est à nous de mettre fin à ce système d'incarcération, détention et déportation. Et Lucy, je ne sais pas si tu écoutes, mais we love you, Lucy, et la lutte continue pour ramener Lucy ici. Solidarité avec Lucy.
Lucy also recorded an interview for the rally today. We're going to play that for you now.
Bueno, entonces, mi nombre es Lucy Francineto Granados. Fui arrestada en mi apartamento en el año 2018 por 4 agentes de inmigración a las 5:50 de la mañana, un día martes 20 de marzo. Y fui deportada un 13 de abril 2018. Pues esa deportación ha sido muy dura para mí, porque la verdad no fue una deportación normal, fue una deportación como secuestro que yo viví, porque no me tenían que sacar por el lugar por donde yo tenía que salir, me sacaron por otro lugar donde rompieron malla, haciendo una mini puerta para poderme sacar por ahí y llevarme hasta el destino del avión. Es una deportación que fue dura para mí. Hasta la fecha de hoy no lo puedo olvidar. Yo sentía que me moría en ese encierro. Y no quiero que a nadie le pase nada similar, porque es triste estar uno en ese lugar. Más cuando migración lo agarra a uno y lo golpea, uno queda traumado. Y yo estuve a punto de volverme loca en ese lugar. Yo no hallaba las horas que me sacaran de ahí, porque mi mente se estaba perdiendo. Y yo agradezco mucho, porque tuve muchas personas y tengo personas que nunca me dejaron de ir a ver. Y me sentía bien porque mi mente se despejaba. Y ahora yo quiero pedirle al gobierno de Canadá un llamado al gobierno que por favor cierre las cárceles, porque con esta epidemia mucha gente se puede enfermar más de la mente. Mucha gente traumada por esta enfermedad, que no quisieran estar encerradas. Por favor, un llamado al gobierno.
So just to translate very quickly for everyone here. So what Lucy's saying, my name is Lucy Francineth Granados. I was arrested in my apartment in 2018 by 4 immigration agents at 5:50 in the morning on a Tuesday, March 20th, and I was deported on April 13th, 2018. Well, that deportation has been very hard for me, because the truth is that it was not a normal deportation. It was more like a kidnapping, what I experienced, because they did not have to take me out of the detention center through the place where I was supposed to exit. They took me out through another place where they broke the mesh, making a mini door to be able to get me out of there and take me to the destination of the plane. It is a deportation that was hard for me. Until today, I cannot forget it. I felt like I was dying in that confinement, and I don't want anything like that to happen to anyone else, because it's sad to be in that place. More so when immigration grabs you and hits you. One is traumatized. One is traumatized, and I was about to go crazy in that place. I couldn't wait when the hour came to get out of there, because my mind was getting lost. And I am very grateful, because I had many people, and have people, who never stopped going to see me. And I felt good because my mind cleared when they came. My mind cleared, and now I want to ask the government of Canada to call on the government to please close the prisons, because with this epidemic, many people can become more mentally ill. Many people who are already traumatized by this disease, who do not want to be locked up. Please, this is a call to the government.
2 people have reportedly died in a Quebec-based prison because of COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. One was 72-year-old Robert Langevin, who died while incarcerated in Bordeaux or Montreal prison. Another person who officials have not named died last spring at the Multi-Security Federal Training Center, a federal prison in Laval, which is just steps away from this parking lot. I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you're listening to CKUT. Welcome back to Off the Hour on 90.3 FM. For the second segment of the hour, we're going to revisit a January 2021 conversation about changing education as the city's students start facing finals 1 year after their schools went online. Indigenous students based in Montreal schools like CEGEPS have been organizing to change the way we define and make space for learning in a classroom, and their work is still ongoing now. Here's that January segment. Educators and students with the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network met this week in a webinar to talk about ways to transform traditional CEGEP education. They say they hope to tackle systemic racism in the Quebec colleges. Writer Kote Natewe, an Anishinaabe student at Dawson College, says the province is behind on acting and people are feeling the effects.
Why is Quebec more late than other provinces? Well, I guess it's just because Quebec doesn't recognize that systemic racism doesn't exist. You know, Legault said it himself, it doesn't exist. And clearly it does in so many examples, but with the most recent one, you know, with George Sechequan, you can't even go to get the help you need, the help you need to be healthy. And even there's another one from Ganasadage, this old man, he was sent home in nothing but, I forget what they're called, what you wear when you're in the hospital, the gown, nothing else. And that's just the health system. And we go look at the legal system, you know, they call it the justice system, but is it really justice?
Miriam Imak is an Inuit student at John Abbott College. For this next segment, she'll explain how the network's mission extends past just changing course content.
My name is Miriam Imak, and I come from a village in Nunavik called Kangiksolochak. I moved here when I was 2 years old to Chojake, colonially known as Montreal, and yeah, been here ever since.
You are a student, right? And you're part of the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network. Can you tell me a little bit about that network?
It's a grassroots network of mainly Indigenous, either faculty or students and non-Indigenous faculty, professors, who are coming together to find ways to act upon dismantling colonization within the CEGEP school systems, addressing particular, I guess, blocks or obstacles to overcome within their specific CEGEP.
How long have you been part of that network?
I've been a part of the network for, I'd say, about a year now. It was within my third semester that I started to get more involved and invited into these groups in this circle of people who are looking to make change. It's given me like a space to be able to speak my realities within the school system. It's also put me in a space where like professors and deans are on like the same level, I guess you can say, like in terms of validity in a sense, because if we look at like school systems in general, there is a like a hierarchy within like who can make decisions and how like certain funding and like big decision making is up to like this creates a safe space for people to collaborate and to learn from each other. Because as a teacher, you're going to have to be a perpetual student to be a good teacher, and vice versa. To be a good student, you also should be able to teach. And I feel like that's the kind of dynamic that is fostered within IDN, which is really powerful and uplifting.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what you shared at the webinar this week?
Yeah. So this week we spoke about mainly our experiences within the school system. So my mom and I moved to Jojage when I was 2 years old for a multitude of reasons. And it's mainly to gain access to resources that have been granted to the, or given, I guess, to the settler population in Canada in Jojage, but they are not given to the people in the remote communities in the north, such as drinkable water and proper healthcare resources, or even mental health care is non-existent in the north. Adequate housing is definitely something that we wanted to be able to access. And that's not something that is easily to come by in the north. There is usually overcrowding and a whole lot of lateral violence due to intergenerational trauma caused by the Canadian government and assimilation. So with all that, we came to Montreal and we went to school. I mean, I went to school in Montreal, Jojage, and my experience was that I'd always be like the token Indigenous person, especially within history class, where there was a lack of truth and I didn't see myself properly represented in these books. So I didn't really have a full scope of who I really was and where my ancestors came from. And one of the questions I was asked was if I lived in an igloo, which is a really good reflection of how Canada wants to erase us completely and how they've enforced this in so many different aspects. Within law, but also contemporarily within how they're educating their youth, who then don't know the truth about the history, so they don't fully comprehend what we're facing on an everyday basis. They go into like professions like healthcare and policing the law when they can't fully help us because they haven't been given the adequate training and education as a child as to where they are, where they're standing, where are you located right now, what is the history of this location, and how does your privilege affect those who have been oppressed and are still being oppressed. So within high school, the same thing happened. Like, there was no proper education on what really happened. I was misrepresented. We were seen as like frozen in time and that we don't really exist contemporarily. And like what that means to be a contemporary native when a lot of our culture has been taken from us. And we are seen as like non-existent. So it's kind of like this one foot in, one foot out kind of scenario, and trying to like map that whole scenario out. And then in Sejeb, that was the first time where teachers themselves brought content of truth. I met one of my favorite professors, and she introduced teachings of the elders and the relocation, the forced relocation of Inuit people, the dog slaughters. All this was new information to me, and I was only receiving this in Sejeb, and that really flipped it all for me. And it wasn't because of the Canadian school system that implemented this information into the textbooks or like anything like that. It was the teachers themselves that found it important for their students to know. So that's where I learned a lot of what I know now. And that's where I also learned about IDN and working to decolonize the school system.
In your experience, like being communication and being like in community with people with IDN, did you find that you were hearing the same stories at different CEJIPs and different institutions around the school system? Did you find that your experience at John Abbott was echoed in different places as well?
Yeah. Within IDN, it's like a multitude of different CEJIPs who are working towards the same end goal. And I feel like this is great work to, like, if we look at this like a tree, we're like pruning the branches, and it's important to fine tune things. But the school system of Canada is rooted in genocide and assimilation. So I feel like they're like, this needs to be totally uprooted to really bring balance and equilibrium. But the, I feel like IDN is really good first steps to be able to even reverse this pyramid, where instead of having it like the few make decisions for the many, it would be more of like the many making decisions for themselves. You know how Indigenous people have been doing this traditionally, and bringing this more into the forefront. It needs to be totally like uprooted to benefit everyone. Like, this isn't just going to benefit the Indigenous people. It's going to benefit every single person, because there's so many different ways of learning, right? And I just feel like it's so limiting how we're taught in the school system to absorb this information and like regurgitate it and take other, like, it's one way of learning, right? And it can bring a lot of understanding, but that's not the only way. We can be learning in so many different holistic ways and integrating different knowledges and teachings to be able to have a more self-determining angle of comprehending our realities and sharing knowledge and sharing information within like a cycle, instead of like I teach you as like a professor looking down to the students, more as like we teach each other and breaking down this illusion of like hierarchy, because that doesn't work. Like, it hasn't worked for the majority of the students, for their mental, emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're talking about not only like a reformation of content, but also a reformation of like the style of teaching and the actual framework that means what is actually learning.
Right. Is preparing us. These job markets are usually working for like large corporations and to build the economy. Whereas like learning and education happens every day. And like, it's not just what we read in a book, it's what we experience in our lives. And how we learn from even our mistakes and to transmute them into like what we're going to do in the future. So it's also experiential what we learn. And I feel like that needs to be integrated and to work in community and to know what that truly means. What does it mean to be in a community anymore? Like, I feel like we're the tactic that is to divide and conquer is so instilled in us that it's more about getting ahead than to work, when it would be so much more potent and powerful to like build bridges and alliances and to work together and build something even more powerful and beautiful that we couldn't do alone. So like building gardens and learning how to live sustainably so that we don't have to depend on higher forces who want us to depend on them and to play God in a sense. That has to go.
Specifically about your CJEP experience, one, I have a question about like, what are you interested in studying? Like, what type of topic are you looking into? And in addition, how has this last year of online school been for you?
What I love to do is, well, like right now I'm loving what I'm doing in my classes because it's focused on my culture, and we're learning more about the utilitarian aspect of like our clothing and how much like we integrated science into what we did in our everyday lives without labeling it as science, you know? The formation of our igloos and the just bringing it back, going back to how friggin' amazing cultures are, and specifically our culture is, and the revitalization of all that was taken and all that we're taking back. So I'm just loving that and learning my language, Inuktitut, my mother tongue. I used to speak Inuktitut when I was a little girl, and I lost a lot of it on the way. So just like going back to learning more about it and working to speak fluently in Inuktitut. So that's what I've been loving, especially incorporating art into it. And in regards to COVID, it's been pretty intense, especially with the homeless population. Like I've been volunteering at a shelter, and it's been like nerve-wracking because I'm thinking of my health and well-being, but these people don't even have like a space to go to, and we're confined in our homes when all I want to do is like go out and like be present and be like, I feel like I need to be doing something. Like, I feel like it's the reverse of what's going on, where these huge corporations are continuing their work, whereas like these little businesses are seen as like non-essential, which like is so reversed to me. And like these people in power are like they have power, you know, like they choose what happens to people, everyday people, especially people who are vulnerable. So it's so important for these people to be cultured and who know the reality of the everyday person and stuff like that. But like, yeah, within COVID, I just feel like it's made me look at myself more and be more introspective. And it's forced me into that space.
If a university student was listening to this, what would you want them to know about schooling, about how your conversation about changing and decolonizing CJEPs also applies to them?
It's a beautiful accomplishment, but it should also be understood that that is not the only way of receiving knowledge and to have a powerful opinion, because experiential knowledge is just as potent, you know. It's important to understand where even the CJEP and university system has roots, and that every way of learning is like a beautiful way, and it's not necessarily that everyone learns in that way and that it's okay, because it doesn't make one person more innately valuable than another because they have a degree, you know, or that they are smart or intelligent. There are many ways of learning and knowing, to just keep that in mind. That's what I would say.
That was Miriam Imak with the Intercollegiate Decolonization Network. To learn more about the network and to read action steps that students can take in their own schools, they're at idn.netboard.me.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
And as always, we want to walk through what happened in the past week, but share some news you can use first. Solidarity Across Borders and other grassroots groups will announce a plan tomorrow to march from Montreal to Ottawa in 7 days. The march is to demand the regularization of all migrants. The announcement will take place at 11 a.m. outside of Guy Favreau Complex on René Lévesque West. And the province recently released its 2021-2022 budget. It's the first budget since the start of the pandemic, and officials say it won't be balanced until at least 7 years. If you want to read more about how the funds are allocated, you can find it on Quebec's Finance Ministry website. And in lighter news, Matatron Press and Antiism Books are hosting a virtual reading with 6 Montreal-based authors tomorrow on YouTube Live. Visit the Matatron Press Instagram page for more information. The reading is tomorrow from noon to 2 p.m. And CKUT programmers have run the station from home for over a year now, which means we're running a funding drive until Sunday. Our off-the-hour team wants to raise $100. If you can help and donate, you can call 514-448-4041 or mail a check to CKUT or do it online at ckut.ca. That concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective, which includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Sarah Jesmer, and Kate Addison. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at newsintern@ckut.ca, and you can connect with us on Instagram, search at Off the Hour. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next.
CK
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to ckut.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change.
CKUT shut down our studios for the safety of each other. Gradually, we adapted and found ways to continue to produce programming that reflects our shared experience, physically distanced but socially connected. Help us keep that connection by donating to CKUT. Call 514-448-4013. Pop a check in the mail, 3647 University Montreal, H3A2B3, or donate online at ckut.ca.
CKUT's annual funding drive runs Thursday, March 18th to Sunday, March 28th. Our programmers have been working hard at home all year, and it's time to celebrate their efforts. The theme of our first ever online drive is sowing the seeds of grassroots change, and we're asking you to support independent community media. Help us reach our goal of $25,000. Go to ckut.ca to donate today.
Sowing the seeds of change, seeds of change. Sowing the seeds, sowing the seeds of change. Seeds of change, sowing the seeds of change.
Bonsoir à tous